All right, our guest on the podcast today is Daniel Wren, CFP. He's a financial planner. He's been a partner with the White Coat Investor now for several years. And in fact, I have known Daniel from some other instances as well. He's come out and skied with me a couple of times here in Salt Lake. And it turns out he's a very accomplished skier. I tried to kill him the first time we went skiing. We went off the off a cliff there at Solitude up Big Cottonwood Canyon, and he negotiated it just fine. So if you're looking for a good skier as a financial advisor, he might be your guy, but usually that's not on people's list of requirements. At any rate, welcome to the show, Daniel.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and it was good to come out and see you last year as well in Kentucky.
Yeah, you got to check out the horse track.
Yeah, we went and checked out the horse track. So this is great. He really wined and dined me there. We went and got breakfast at the horse track, which was an excellent breakfast and a very blue collar crowd. It was a fun time.
We like fancy places out here.
Yeah, it was pretty fancy. But the nice thing about it is when you look at how Daniel manages his money, you know, he's going to be just as careful with yours as he is with his. And so that's actually a good thing in my book when I see somebody that's, you know, relatively frugal.
Yeah, cruising in my 2003 Avalon.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, speaking of financial planning, why did you decide to become a financial planner?
Well, I'd say like in the early days, so I started in 2005, but initially I was kind of drawn to like the idea of just generally helping people with money. I was kind of into finance. That's what I took my degree was in finance. So I kind of like that idea, the whole idea of helping people with money. I'm also kind of a technical guy, like I'm pretty analytical. And so, you know, financial planning is, you can kind of get into the weeds a little bit as well. So, but what really I think has kept me in it and I really enjoyed the most is seeing people realize the benefits of good financial planning. So actually helping people through that whole process and seeing them kind of get to that point where they're not worried about their finances or they're, you know, on track for their goals. That's what I would say has really kept me in it.
So is there a bad part? I mean, what's the worst part of being a financial planner?
The tough part is when people don't execute.
Why is that tough for you? I mean, I know why that's tough for them, but why is that tough for you?
Well, it's you put all the work in, you know, to putting a plan together. And if somebody doesn't do any of it, it's kind of like, what's the point of this?
You feel like you're wasting your time sometimes.
It's kind of like if you're seeing a patient and they, you know, don't do a single thing you say, that I'm sure that can be a little frustrating. So that doesn't happen very often, fortunately, but it does happen.
Well, I mean, with either job, I think there's a little bit of getting buy-in and motivating and, you know, trying to get somebody to change their behavior in a lot of ways. So,
yeah.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about your firm and why it's unique. I mean, your firm is Wren Financial, Wren Financial Planning. You can find that at Wren Financial. That's W-R-E-N-N-E financial.com. Tell us about your firm.
So we've been around since 2014. I transitioned from my other firm, started this firm. So I would say what makes us unique is we have a really high concentration of young physician families in particular, which has been really helpful because we've kind of been able to really hone in on what sort of problems they have and then, you know, cater solutions to that specific type of situation. Also, what's been kind of nice is developing over time. I came up in the industry where it's kind of like an eat what you kill. Like every advisor has their own little business entity. That's just kind of a lot of how the industry is set up. But what we've set our business up is to be more like a team. So there's two CFPs now, myself and Jen Quire. We have some support staff as well, but we've been developing it and building it to be more of like a team sort of environment to where there's not, it's not just your clients, my clients. It's more of like everybody works with everybody to add more value. We have very flexible services compared to the norm. We've set it up to kind of have like a option for do-it-yourselfer types where we can kind of give them advice, give them the tools and hand it off to them. And then we've also got a little bit more robust services where they can kind of like outsource more stuff to us if they're not really into doing it themselves. And then all of that, we offer kind of a flat fee setup where we can incorporate all of that. We try to steer away from conflicts of interest when we can. So that's, I feel like, a less conflicted model.
Now, you do a lot of student loan advice as well because you've got these young physician families.
Yeah, we manage more student loans than we do assets. That's kind of our We got a lot of student loans that we're helping people out with.
So fiduciary, fee only, no commissions, transparent pricing.
Yeah.
You know, those things you forget to mention, but they're really rare in the financial advisory world. Now, they're not rare on my list of recommended advisors, but they are rare in the general financial advisor world.
Yeah.
Sometimes we gloss over that kind of stuff.
Yeah, your list is a good list, but if we're talking about the industry as a whole, yes, those are big time differentiators.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's get to some listener questions here. Our first question's on the SpeakPipe. This is coming from Tyler, who's a graduating medical student. Let's listen to his question here.
Hi, Dr. Dolly. I'm a relatively new listener and supporter of the White Coat Investor, but I'm a rising fourth year osteopathic medical student, and I'm considering family medicine for residency, mostly in Texas. My wife and I are really serious about moving back to South Texas, or place of low cost of living. And we're about a year out from potentially buying a house. And I know you're very against residents buying a home, but assuming we get residency down there in South Texas, where I'm planning to live, low cost of living, and we want to stay there after residency in our minds, it's close to her family. It's very well thought out in that sense. Do you see any way that a house in the low 200s or even upper 190s would be something that you could endorse, would appreciate your blessing, willing to live like a resident for 2 to 5 years in that same house after residency? Is that something you could get behind and make a rare exception? I will have about $350,000 in student loan debt, of course. I know that's extremely significant. And my wife, we are expecting our first child this September, which would be in the fourth year of medical school. And she has her master's in business, hasn't decided when she would go back to working yet. So, and we are relocating from Tennessee to Texas. Additionally, I'm not planning on doing public service loan forgiveness and plan on refinancing my loans with one of your people in the early part of residency.
Okay, so basically he's buying a house or thinking about buying a house during residency and trying to justify it. What do you think? What would you tell him if he's asking you this?
Yeah, so I give him credit for reaching out for advice first. That's a big deal. So we have like an all-in cost calculator for home purchases. For a $200,000 home, if he's financing 100%, I made a few other assumptions, but like our number would be it'd be about $1,800 a month, like all in, and that includes everything. So what's a resident's take-home pay going to be, Jim? What do you think? Like,
I mean, I think they're probably averaging 60,000 now, 55,000, 60,000.
So like, let's say
take home 3,000, 3,500, something like that.
That's what I was thinking. So that's like what, 1,200, 1,500 a month left over after the mortgage payment and everything else that comes with it. So that's part of the challenge, is that is not very much, I would say not enough wiggle room when you have $350,000 of student loans and a kiddo on the way. It's just not going to be enough wiggle room. And what happens, you buy the house. When I bought my house the first year, actually, we had like two big, huge trees that we had to take down totally unexpectedly. And I mean, it's like $5,000. And all of a sudden, so that's where residents go into credit card debt. So in short, I would say I would steer clear of that and not do that. And instead like rent and really shoot for a lower priced rental as well. It's just not going to be enough wiggle room.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of owning during residency period. Now you can tell he's read that recommendation, you know, based on how he asked the question. And so he justifies it by saying, hey, I'm going to stay in the house after residency. Well, when you're going to be there for 5, 6, 8 years, yeah, the numbers start changing a little bit as far as renting versus buying. Now, still, you got to keep it within, you know, something you can afford. You can't rent something that costs $2,000 any more than you can buy something that costs you $2,000 a month. But once you get out there to where you're holding on to it for a while, then sometimes it can make sense. But the problem here is that attendings don't like living in resident houses. You know, once you're making $200,000 a year or $250,000 a year or $400,000 a year, it's really hard to get excited about living in that house you could actually afford as a resident. And so kudos to those who can do it for a while, but I think planning to do it for years and years afterward in order for the decision to make sense is probably folly.
Yeah, there's also a little trick I've seen with lenders that's probably important to mention is they commonly will really emphasize like grace period on your student loans and potentially even like deferment or forbearance. Just that's going to help you close the loan better or faster or more efficiently. And that's like a terrible decision. Like going into grace period on your loans is typically unwise.
Yeah.
And it's just a bad start.
Especially for Tyler here. I mean, Tyler's looking at doing family medicine, so presumably he'll have a lower than average physician income. Maybe he's making $200,000 when he gets out, and he owes $350,000 in student loans. So he says he's not going for public service loan forgiveness, but maybe he should be, right? You know, even if he doesn't make all these tiny payments during residency, just that debt to income ratio, he's still going to come out ahead doing public service loan forgiveness if he can get a job that qualifies for it. And so maybe he ought to look at that a little bit more carefully. I'm sure there's plenty of places in South Texas for a family doc that are where you'd be directly employed by a 501c3. So whether it's a community health center or what, that's probably something to look at a little bit more carefully with a debt to income ratio like that.
Yeah, I agree.
All right, let's take the next question. This one comes from Dustin.
I'm a small practice owner with two docs and one PA. I'm interested in starting a retirement plan for the office, like a 401k or profit sharing plan of some kind. I assumed naturally that this would allow me to save a significant amount of money, but after looking at the amount that I have to pay in fees to administer the plan, according to regulations, I'm giving up 10% or more for everything that I can save right off the bat. This means that I'll have to be in a significantly lower tax bracket in the future in order to recoup that kind of expense. The lack of a retirement plan right now does not seem to be a barrier to hiring quality employees, so I'm not sure if it would be better for me to just not offer a plan and save the money that I would otherwise have paid into it into a taxable account and plan for retirement otherwise. I'm curious what your advice would be to a business owner who has to cover some of the expenses. A retirement plan seems like a great deal for employees, but I'm not so sure it's great for the practice owner. Thanks for the advice.
Okay, so basically Dustin's asking here, should I start a retirement plan for my office? What do you think? What would you tell him to do if he came in and started talking about those fees and the match he'd have to pay for his employees? Would you say, go for it, don't go for it? What should he consider?
Yeah, that's another great question that most people don't ask, which kudos to him for asking it. I would say if he's not really interested in the like additional like recruitment retention type benefits associated with the retirement plan, then no, I don't think it's a good deal. I think the taxable route is typically better, especially if he's trying to do like matching and safe harbor, which is typically going to be required for him to do what he needs to do in his share of the retirement plan. Those costs just add up. So Michael Kitz is, you know, Michael stuff, right, Jim?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
He wrote a great article where he like dug into all the weeds of this kind of a thing, like comparing taxable versus small business retirement plan. And if your listeners are interested in kind of digging in the weeds, I would strongly recommend that sort of article. I don't know if you can link to it in the show notes or whatnot, but
yeah, I'm sure we can find that and put it in the show notes.
But it's a great kind of deep dig into the math behind it. But yes, typically it's going to be better. He's going to be better off, especially if he uses, you know, low cost, low turnover type investments, because you're not going to really generate much tax anyway.
Yeah. I think the key here is what he's saying about his employees. It's like, my employees don't value this. And the problem with that is it costs you just as much money as giving them a higher salary.
Right.
You know, and so if they don't value it, then they're not going to look at it as part of their salary, which is how you look at it as a business owner on the bottom line, because it costs you just as much as it does to pay them more. And so, you know, when they don't value it, I think it's hard to do. But I've always said practice retirement plan. Once you have employees, this is no longer a do-it-yourself project. It's time to get a pro involved and help run the numbers and decide what plan is right for you.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's a simple IRA. Sometimes it's a SEP IRA. Sometimes it's a 401k. And there's half a dozen ways you can structure that for a practice. Sometimes it is not having a plan and just investing in taxable. I mean, you can still do, you know, a backdoor Roth IRA for you and your spouse each year. Maybe your spouse has a job and they have a 401k available. So there's other things you can do. But the bottom line is, you know, when you're paying just as much in fees and match as you are actually saving in taxes for using this account, and if the employees aren't valuing it, you know, then forget it. You know, why bother?
Yeah, no, definitely not worth it. But it's definitely a very, very complicated analysis. Like there's a million different ways to structure it, like you said. So that's a good point too.
Yeah. Okay. So let's take our last question we're going to do together. This one comes from someone who calls herself Clueless in Connecticut. And she's actually got two speak pipes with her questions on here. Let's listen to both of them all together. And then we'll go through her actual questions here.
Hi, Dr. Dolly. You answered one of my questions before on the podcast, and I figured I would turn to you for additional advice. I currently work as an employed physician at a health center that offers 401k retirement plans to all of its employees. My employer does offer a match, 100% of the first 3% invested, and then 50% of the next 2% invested. When I was first hired shortly after residency, I was pretty unfamiliar with investments and didn't know what an index fund was. I began contributing the max allowed, and thus far, the majority of the funds are in the JP Morgan Smart Retirement Plan, the 2050 plan, Class A to be exact. There are several expense ratios that are listed, and I'm not sure which one is the quote-unquote true expense ratio. For example, there's an annual report gross expense ratio of 0.53, an annual report net expense ratio of 0.37, and a prospectus net expense ratio of 0.88. The second part of my question is that in learning more about investing, I decided to transfer the money from my rollover IRA from residency into my current 401k. But for this rollover, I have it attributed to the Vanguard 500 Index Admiral Fund. Over the past few years, my job's 401k has added two additional Vanguard funds, the Total Bond Market Index and the Vanguard Total International Stock Index. I'm considering reallocating the funds that are in the JP Morgan Smart 2050 plan and doing my own three-fund portfolio, which would comprise of 90% stocks. I'm considering 55% of that would be in the Admiral, the 500 Index Admiral, 35% in the Total International Stock Index, and then the remaining 10% in the Total Bond Market Index. I'm curious to know your thoughts on the strategy. I'm 36 years old, and I have at least 20, if not 30 more years left to practice. Is this too aggressive? And how and when should I reallocate? Am I reallocating all existing money or only new contributions? Also, should the stock price influence my decision? For example, the Total International Stock Index price is $27.18 per share, whereas the Vanguard 500 Index Admiral is $258.20 per share. Thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate all the advice you've given thus far.
Okay, so our first one is she's trying to figure out what expense ratio she's actually paying on this JP Morgan 2050 fund. How do you help people figure that out?
Yeah, I think she was specifically the one she was referring to that was correct was the net expense ratio. So net is a good word to look for. It's 0.88 on the specific fund she was asking about. But I think my suggestion would be try to look to other sources. A lot of times the stuff you get through your retirement plan provider is very difficult to interpret. And so I do this myself is I'll go to like Morningstar or a brokerage firm website, like a, you know, TD Ameritrade or E-Trade or something like that, and then look up the ticker there. If it's got a ticker, if it's got the five word or five letter abbreviation, you can look it up anywhere. And a lot of times they'll just show you the real expense ratio.
Yeah, what people have to realize is that especially with a lot of these, you know, I hate to say advisor sold because they're not really advisors, broker sold funds is maybe the proper term. You know, these loaded mutual funds, there are multiple share classes. You know, there's A and C and B and J and N, and, you know, it all has the same fund name, but it's a different share class with a different ticker and a different expense ratio. And sometimes some of those share classes have a load, even inside a 401k. And so you really have to get to the bottom of that particular fund to see what you're really paying. And what you'll sometimes find out is that you're paying a 5% load plus a 1.5% expense ratio. And that's obviously a terrible fund to be using, especially if you got better options in the 401k, which it sounds like this doc does. Which brings us to her second questions here. Should I move my money out of this JP Morgan, you know, target retirement fund into something else? And what would you talk to her about if she was asking that to you?
All day long. That particular JP Morgan fund has 8 different share classes. So that, like you were just saying, that's a classic example. And the one she was referring to, it has some commissions and stuff like that built into it. So the alternative funds she was asking about, they're just plain vanilla Vanguard funds, and they're going to be way lower cost funds. So that's a fantastic move, is to, as long as she can set up a kind of a systematic method, plan for keeping them balanced the way she needs to, then that's a definitely a great move, because she's going to be able to cut her expense ratio, you know, like 80% or something like that, a ton as a result of doing that.
Yeah. So she asks, is it too aggressive to go into a 3-fund portfolio? You know, she's talking about going out of a 2050, you know, target retirement fund, which has got to be 90% stock or something like that. Anyway, I haven't looked at the specific asset allocation in this fund.
It's almost the exact same.
Yeah, I don't think it's too aggressive necessarily to go into a 3-fund portfolio. So it's about the same thing. You're just reducing your expenses.
Right. Her that particular fund, the JP Morgan fund, it was like almost to the percent the exact same.
Yeah. It also sounds like she doesn't understand exactly how rebalancing works. Can you explain to the listeners how you should rebalance a portfolio?
Yeah. So if she was, I think she was saying targeting like 55% in the S&P fund, 35% international, 10% bond. So that would be like your target allocation. And so you initially, when you decide that's the target, then you say, okay, let's move 100% of my JP Morgan fund into that new given percentage for the existing balance. And then for new money, you set it to go to that target as well. But what happens is, over time, you know, the S&P 500 does worse or better than the international index or the bond index. They're all kind of moving differently. And so you get a little bit out of whack. Slowly over time, it gets a little bit more out of whack. So every so often, what rebalancing is you're just kind of reshuffling it to get back to that original target, which was the 55, 35, 10 for her situation.
So you're doing it for all the existing money. You're not doing it just for your new contributions. You're changing everything when you rebalance.
Yeah. And most 401k platforms, they make you do it separately. Like, you have to change your existing balance and then separately have to change your new contribution targets. And typically you want to do both, because that's going to keep it closer to the target over time.
Right. And so what do you do at your firm for rebalancing? Do you do it based on time? You rebalance everybody's portfolio once a year? Or do you use a band-based method when they're really out of whack? You rebalance the whole thing? Or how do you guys do it?
It's kind of like both. It's quarterly we look at it, and then quarterly, or if it gets more than 20% out of variance. So it's a pretty big or pretty wide band, but it's one or the other.
So it could be triggered more frequently than quarterly in a time period like 2008.
Yeah, it's basically like quarterly or if the market gets crazy.
Yeah. Okay, her last question was about the stock price. And she seemed to wonder if it mattered if an ETF was priced at $50 or $150. Does that make any sort of a difference?
No.
Yeah. I actually like the lower prices, because you're less likely to have, you know, $70 sitting in cash when you're done buying.
Yeah.
You know, ETFs. If you got to buy an ETF on the market, then you got less money sitting in cash if the price is lower.
Yeah.
But for a mutual fund that you're just putting all your money in, it doesn't matter at all. You either own more shares at a higher price, or more shares at a lower price, or fewer shares at a higher price, but it's really the exact same thing. So I agree, and doesn't matter. All right. Well, those are the questions I had for you. I appreciate you coming on the podcast today and answering questions with me. If you're interested in hiring Daniel, you can find him at renfinancial.com. That's Ren, WRENNE. And obviously, you can also find him on my recommended financial advisors page. I think he's right at the top there.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, Jim. I'm coming to Utah 2 times this winter skiing, so I'll have to hit you up then. I look forward to hitting the slopes.
Sweet.
And we'll, I don't
try
know,
not to kill you this time.
You gave me a little bit too much props on my skiing skills. I don't know if I'm quite to that level.
Well, if you can follow me around and not die while I'm exploring at the resort, I'd say that's pretty good. So
yeah, I did my best.
All right. We'll catch you next time.
Yeah. Thanks.
All right. That was great having Daniel on. I think he's a great advisor. He's young enough too that he's still going to be around for your career. So, but he's still been doing this plenty of years to have the experience you need from someone, but he's not going to retire on you in the next few years either. So if you're looking for someone that's going to take as much care of your money as you will, I think he's a great choice.